Well, thanks for coming today to Friday night. I mean, we talked about this yesterday with that discussion on the text for Sunday. You know, there's the uniqueness of a place like Holden. You can get people to read the Bible on Friday night. What we'll do is really just make our way through the book of Esther. I'll make a couple of brief comments at the beginning for us to think about, but mostly I hope that it's something we will take part and read and talk about the story that you know that it tells it. And so participation and having fun with the text is an important part. It's intended to be able to tell you that. So we'll start with a couple of brief things. First, what are biblical characters that come to mind for you? What biblical characters? Let's try to make a quick list of biblical characters.
So in general?
In general. Any stories that come to mind. Biblical stories that come to mind. So, you know, if we were to make a list of these characters and kind of reflect on the ones and when we have come to know their stories, you know, for most, if we think about the way that biblical stories are looked at early on in our lives, if you grow up and go into a religious tradition that uses a biblical text and then you go to Sunday school or within the Jewish tradition, if you would, you know, participate in kind of religious education, most of the biblical stories that we know well tend to be primarily the stories of men. The stories of women are oftentimes the ones that we learn later on, you know, when you sort of go a little bit more in depth. They're not, if you look at a traditional children's Bible, for example, it will contain very few stories of women. The second thing is, when you think about the list of names that we mentioned, how many of them are immigrants? How many of them do you think of as immigrants?
Migrants, possibly more than immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you make that difference? What would be the difference?
I think not having a home. And mm-hmm. immigrants are people who are trying to establish, and you know, trying out a home, but migrants tend to move more throughout the land. I don't know. I mean, I'm just being picky, but migration seems to be more of a thing than immigration.
So something as to whether people have a destination that they're moving towards,
right.
or if it's just a part of their lives. Do you think more like a nomad, almost like a migrant, almost like a nomad?
Well, nomads do it because that's the culture. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people are forced into migration because the land is taken over, oppression, wars, dealing with what happens in life when you're forced out and you're in the desert or you're, you know, crossing through a foreign land that you're not sure you want to be in. I don't know. Migration, to me, says a lot. Maybe I'm very poor at expressing what it says.
I think, you know, it might be helpful to think in terms of maybe that broader sense, because I think that's a helpful way to think of it. To think of migration as a broader experience, not only of people who migrating to a particular direction, crossing a national border, which is also in itself kind of like a modern concept as well. You know, the idea that there are national borders that you're crossing, you know, these things are things that kind of shape differently. But so if we think of it in more the broader sense of migration, so again, if we go back through that list of characters that we talked about in the biblical text, the ones that come to mind, which ones of them are migrants?
Mary and Joseph.
The only people that aren't migrants in the Old Testament are the king.
Good point.
They're the only people that escape.
And even the ones that becoming kings will be migrants. You know, like David certainly, you know, goes back and forth through most of his life, you know, in and out of the kingdom and then also having to run away. So that even some of those in their way to be kings, but that's an interesting thing to notice as well. The kings are the only ones who have stood there.
Of course, Abraham.
When you read scripture growing up, or even as you think about listening to texts through the biblical story, how often do you hear that aspect of their, you know, the fact that they are immigrants play into it? I mean, is that something that does the fact that they're immigrants affect it in any way? And does that normally get thought of as part of the way we understand their stories.
Well, a lot of the characters, when they're moving about, when they enter and then they're the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get, they become the target of aggression because
mm-hmm.
they're the outside culture. In Egypt and elsewhere, they are, because they've come there as a mass group,
mm-hmm.
they also leave in that way
mm-hmm.
and are targets of oppression, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So exclusion is one of the ways in which we might, when we hear these stories, we might recognize that aspect of their experience or their character, you know, that they live as outsiders within the culture that they're a part of. And as outsiders, it's not like maybe that, you know, we receive some kind of exclusion or oppression. So how often have you, I guess the question is more general, how often have you thought of these characters as immigrants and what difference, or a migrant, and what difference does it make to think of them in that way? What difference might it make to read them and to see them as migrants?
I think we don't, because we're looking for guidance in our own life.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that those of us who are not migrants, and even though we're in transition possibly, we're not migrating through cultures, we're reading the Bible for guidance in our lives that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I were a migrant, I might read the Bible differently and see more of the point. So if you're asking the group, I only speak for myself, I think I kind of gloss over it and I don't really, you know, it's not really, because it's not part of what my experience is.
Yeah. And so what I invite you to do as we read the story of Esther is actually to think about that and to realize that, in a way, if we go to explain migration, if we think of migration more broadly, define it more broadly, to some extent, most of us are migrants. You know, in certainly the time that people spend in, right now here in Poland, it's a migrant community in many ways. Nobody sort of belongs here. Everybody ultimately is an outsider to this place and becomes an insider for a period of time and then leaves. And if you come back, even having been on staff and come back, you know, a couple of months later, it's like it's a different place. It feels, that it's changed significantly over that period of time. So think about the times in which your own life you have experienced some form of migration and movement, and to try to think, how would that experience be one of the lenses through which I look at the text as we read through it. What you were pointing out, John, I think is part of what has interested me as part of my sabbatical. I'm on sabbatical for this year, as most of you know. I'm a campus pastor at Luther College in the Core, Iowa. And migration is something that's been a part of my own life personally. I grew up in Guatemala and then came to the U.S., went to school in Texas Lutheran, and then, you know, through seminary and then work. I lived in a couple of different countries, and so most of my adult life has been shaped by a physical experience of migration, you know, physically crossing borders. And so it's shaped a lot of the way that I think about myself, and then it also has impacted, to some extent, the way I look at the text. But to the point that, you know, the way we look at things seems like the normal way, right? That's the way I can only look at the world through my own eyes, so to speak. And so it's only been in retrospect that I realized to what extent my own experience of migration has shaped my understanding of the biblical text. And so it sometimes surprises me, taken by surprise, how much others don't necessarily read that. I mean, John has said may have much to do with that. You know, that when we are closer to an experience, we see it more readily in the text. Well, the same should apply in other aspects of the text. We'll be looking at the story of a woman. And so those of you who are women will hear and read this text perhaps differently. And how do we contribute that? That we have found in biblical studies that rather than this idea of the 18th century that kind of hit its height of absoluteness, of objectivity, you know, the sense that scientific approach can all be proven in very, you know, objective sense that there's a truth and a way to look, has really been challenged by the idea that we read in texts and in the world and in experience, the way we read these things or come to them has much to do with our. And my conviction is that all of these lenses enrich the way we hear these texts, enrich the way we experience these, whatever it is that we're approaching, and in this case, the biblical text. So I encourage you to be intentional about those lenses, to think about what is your migration experience, you know, if you lived abroad, traveled abroad, have been sort of displaced one way or the other within your own setting. I mean, sometimes it's a change of jobs that may feel like you're in a new environment. In my work, I, on a campus, I found it very helpful to think of a student's experience when they come to college as an immigrant's experience. Because I worked with refugee resettlement for a couple of years, and then on campus I started to see very much of the same experience for these students who were coming into a place, even though they may have moved across the street or across the state. They were in a place where they knew the language to some extent, but universities have their own language, you know. They have their own set of values. They were going from their own faith traditions defined by their congregations into this place where even being a Lutheran was very different, because there were all these versions of Lutheranism that they were not even exposed to, or of Christianity, or of whatever tradition they came from. So what I realized is that the experience of migration is really much more universal to some extent. And if you want to get sort of philosophical about it, our entire experience as humans is that of immigrants. You know, the biblical text talks about the fact that this is not our earth, you know, this is not our home. We're sort of pilgrims on the way. And to some extent, I think that some of our anxiety about immigrants grows, or particularly, you know, when we talk about it in political terms, our anxiety about immigrants in the country currently, as a nation, in part comes because immigrants remind us of transition. It's similar to the anxiety that adults have about teenagers. You know, there is this quote in the beginning of my book on working with teens that it's this great quote. I mean, it says something about, you know, teens this day, you know, they're disrespectful, they're lazy, they're all this stuff, you know. And it sounds like the Bye Bye Birdies, you know, Kids These Days song. And so there's this constant complaint about teens these days. And you read through it, and it's actually written by Socrates, you know, the 5th century before Christ. And so the sense that there's an anxiety about that generation. So the similarity is that teens are a migration group between childhood and adulthood. They become an external sort of thing that we just don't quite know what to do with. And they remind us of our own transitional nature. So when you think about the level of effort that we as humans make to settle, to feel that we belong, to feel that we have roots, you know, in the way we build our buildings, you know, the early stories of the biblical text is this attempt to build the Tower of Babel. What was the point of the Tower of Babel? Do you remember what it is that people want to make sure it happens? Well, reach heaven is part of it, but why? That's not the reason. That's, you know, we'll reach heaven, but there's a reason why. And it's so that we will not be forgotten. And that we will not be scattered. So the sense is the sense of stability. You know, it's kind of permanence. And immigrants live without permanence. And that's part of what we are afraid of. You know, think about, this is a place, we're living in a community here that is quite comfortable with transition and uncertainty. I mean, most of the folks that come to this place and are here aren't quite sure what's going to happen next, you know? But outside of this place, our comfort level with not knowing what the next step is not quite the same. You know, we want certainty. We want this stability and permanence. So immigrants reflect that, and because of that, reflect that anxiety. So with those lenses in mind, we'll kind of begin the Texas story. My focus for my sabbatical is looking at migration narratives in the biblical text and the way that immigrant communities read them. So, of course, to talk about immigrant communities as a monolithic group is problematic, but there's specific ones I'm working with. I've worked in the Yakima Valley with some of the folks who live there, and some of whom have been here for a Abriendo Caminos. I'll be in Florida during January, working with a different set of immigrant communities there. Iowa and Poso, the site of an immigration raid. We'll talk about that tomorrow some. And then in Guatemala, those will be the 4 communities that I'm hoping to basically read these texts with. The reading of Esther, I just finished reading through the text with a group of women in Poso. Just 2 weeks ago, we finished reading through it. And so some of my own reflections, so, you know, we'll think about as we read through it, will come from that experience. So, what's our time frame? Remind me. I can't remember.
We begin by quarter 2 for sure, because they have to set up a prayer on the cross.
Yep.
No,
we
should keep
it
set up. Oh, they're set up. Never mind.
No, we'll be sure to be done on time. So, because, you know, we're just reading through it, so we'll just quit at 6:45. The first thing to say about, specifically about Esther. So what do we know about Esther? Just real briefly, what do you know about Esther? It's not a test, I just kind of know more or less where everybody's at in the reading of Esther.
She saved her people. very beautiful. She was a Hebrew living in a foreign land, and she was kind of pushy. Yes. I say it in the best way.
Exactly. And you were sharing earlier about the role of the Book of Esther within the tradition of Purim. Has any of you been to a Purim festival in Jewish tradition? So you might share a little bit again about that. You shared that earlier.
Yeah, it's not a high holiday by any means, but it's a fun one. We have a dramatic reading of the story, and there's different traditions, like when the bad guy, who's Haman, his name gets said, you shake a rattler and everyone goes boo, and you're supposed to come to the party, the Purim party, dressed as one of the characters, and sometimes there's a play. Normally we sit in a circle in my synagogue and like read it out loud, and there's cookies, special cookies you eat at the time, like a hamantashen, and they are little triangle cookies that are supposed to signify something about Haman. I don't know, I grew up hearing it was the shape of his hat, and you consume his hat, and you said it was his ears. I don't know, I think it changes from community to community, but it's just a fun holiday.
You talked about it kind of like a Halloween, and I grew up, my family's background on my mom's side of the family is Jewish, and so we grew up celebrating every imaginable holiday, all Jewish holidays, all Christian holidays, all Purim holidays, midnight. We even did Thanksgiving just for fun. So, but Purim was by far one of my favorite. And so the story is great. And so part of what we want to do is to read this text in its intended form, which is to, you know, it's this Purim celebration. And actually, Purim is established by the end of the book. It specifically tells, you know, do this every year and hang out and party. And so there's elements to it. And the best way to think of it, of the book, it's again, and I mentioned this at the beginning because there is intentional extremes in this book. I mean, it's just like everything is very exaggerated. Some of it is parody, some of it is just excess, and it's intended to make a point. It is not a historical book. I mean, it is really painful to read some studies on the Book of Esther that try to make the book historical and try to sort of justify everything that's happening on it. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. The book is intended to be an exaggeration, you know, the way that it is written. And you miss a lot, I think, when you try to sort of fit it into a historical kind of characteristic. Did Esther exist? Did, you know, did this really happen? Those questions really seem irrelevant to the text. You know, some of the elements of it could have happened, may have been inspired by some experiences, but ultimately that's not the way the text is written and intended to be heard or read. And I think that hopefully that will become obvious as we read it. So as we read it, keep in mind the lenses that we bring, gender and power and migration. Keep in mind also some of these things that we'll find in the text, and read it like, in doing this with the group of, in Postville, we talked about, this is a telenovela. And, you know, telenovelas are like over-the-top soap operas, and they vary by country, depending on the origin, so this is like a Mexican telenovela, which is even more over-the-top than any other from South America. And so what are the elements of a soap opera? Drama? What else?
Beauty.
Beauty?
Yeah. Passion.
Passion. Yeah. Suspense. You know,
intrigue.
Plots that kind of get repeated, you know, over and over again. There's a lot of repetitive.
Yeah.
And
the layered relationships.
So a lot of tangled relationships and things going on, intrigue that it's a... So again, all these things to keep in mind. So this is a telenovela. One of the things we need to do is find characters for each of these. And these will last through the time that we read the text. So we'll start out with a couple. We need somebody to be Esther. So we have a picture in our mind. So who's that actor that you think would make a good Esther? Well, I wouldn't necessarily have to be somebody here. I was thinking more like that.
Oh.
We're like somebody from the movies. Let's think of movies. We have to cast it, but you could play it. So who would be a...
Elizabeth Taylor?
Yeah.
Any other candidates for us to... Right? Mm-hmm. might, you know, will violate all kinds of time frames. So it doesn't matter if they live at the same time, you know. So, and we need a king Ahasuerus, who we'll come back to later. So just somebody to be a king for right now. That's another character we have to keep in mind. So keep those two in mind. We'll add some others later, Haman and some others as we need them. So, or maybe we should add, because that's the triad that we really need, and then Mordecai. So let's come up with the next two. So Mordecai and Haman. So who for, I should be writing these because I will forget. What about for Mordecai? That's the kind of stepfather cousin of Esther.
Paul Newman. Yeah.
Okay. And Elizabeth. And this is quite the classic movie right now. Elizabeth Taylor, Paul Newman, and John Connery. And who else did we say we needed? Haman. Yeah, so what do we do?
Sting.
All right. Oh, my. A little bit interesting. Okay. Now, the things that will happen the way again are the elements we're talking about. Axis, parity, reversals, lots of reversals. So kind of, you know, watch for language and see what you notice in it. And then, so we'll start reading. And we'll need a couple readers for the first part, just narrator one and two, and then somebody to be the king, and somebody to be this guy named Memucan, who's like one of the servants or advisors to the king. So, two narrators. Narrator one. And then for king, Jacob's going to be king.
Sure.
Then we need somebody to be Memucan, the advisors to the king.
I'll do it.
All right. All right, so let's just start reading. And we'll kind of start reading through. I'll stop at different points. Actually, let me ask this. Is it okay if I turn a tape or a recorder real quick? Partly because I am doing this for my spot, it will be interesting to see what it
is. Is Michael recording you?
Yeah. It's actually.
Oh, it's being recorded. Okay. Then
I didn't okay that
would
be that, but we
great.
Do it retroactively.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's good. I don't have to worry about it. Good. All right, so let's start reading.
If this happened in the days of Ahasuerus,
Ahasuerus.
The same Ahasuerus who ruled over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia.
In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his officials and ministers. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were present, while he displayed the great wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days in all.
We'll stop there because these first two paragraphs kind of set the stage. So what have you noticed in those first two?
He's got a big kingdom. Mm-hmm. He hit Ethiopia with. Is it Persia? Is that supposed to be his?
Persia and Media, that's the media, is the one that, you know, it's a reference. So there's something, you know, they tried to kind of match it up to an actual king. It wasn't really a king at his service, but there's actually had about, you know, more or less, or alter sex, was his grandson. One of those two may be, you know, a reference to them, but making fun of one of those two. But, yeah. So a really large kingdom.
And have a banquet for 180 days.
6 months of partying.
Good party.
Yeah. It's quite a... So we begin with this clear sense of a lot of elaborate. How would you stage this if you were doing a movie about it with Sean Connery and Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman?
You have to have a large budget.
Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah.
What's that?
It'd be a Cecil B. DeMille movie.
All right. Where would you stage it? What's a good setting for, you know, 180 days of partying?
Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the Enron stuff or whatever it was. Wasn't after the Enron collapse they were still doing some partying or something? So clearly, the book begins, and think about how the story would have been heard as people begin to listen to it. So there's this exaggerated kingdom. It's just over the top huge, 127 provinces, and we have this huge ongoing party for 6 months. What else do you know about it? Anything else in this affairs? Who's invited?
The nobles, the governor,
the army of Persia.
The army.
So what's the point of this party? It tells us what it is. What's the point of the party?
To win the favor of those.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in charge who would be distributed.
Mm-hmm. So he's
display wealth.
Display wealth and display power. Why would he want to do this?
He's kind of known power.
Only 3 years in power, so this is another heavy detail. You know, he's, you know, a nouveau riche. You know, he's trying a little too hard. So he's brought people from all over the place, and of course, in some ways, it represents kind of like excess in many ways, because he has brought the top nobility together in his kingdom, the top army colonels from everywhere on this huge expanse, and brought them all to one city to party for 6 months. Seems somewhat irresponsible, doesn't it? What will this do to the treasury of the state? What will it do to the protection of the boundaries of the state? You know, to sort of have everybody together in one place. I mean, this is... So the excesses are highlighted. One of the things that the group in Poso noted about this is they asked, who were the servants? Who's making food for 180 days? You know, what's the environment like in this place for all these partying? And it... You know, what kind of an impact does it have on the rest of their community? So, any other aspect here that
sounds like Dubai?
Yeah.
Okay, so what about that?
Dubai has been partying like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And now their cup is empty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the people of Dubai that have been doing all of the work. What you're asking is, where did these people come from that did all the work?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the, you know, that I don't remember the percentage, but you know, the majority of the population of Dubai is not from Dubai. You know, all these imported foreign workers that have come to, you know, grease the party. So this is how we start. What kind of a picture are you getting of King Ahasuerus out of this? And that was the, now, I gotta make sure I got the right guy. Is this Sean Connery? Is he the king? Okay, so what kind of picture are you getting of Sean Connery here as King Ahasuerus?
Frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
Insecure.
Mm-hmm. And that will be a theme that we have to be very mindful of, because we'll keep showing up in terms of gender here too, to figure out insecure man, you know, like with power. That could be very problematic. Well, let's keep reading the next paragraph then. Now that the partying has been going on for 180 days,
when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in the citadel of Susa, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and blue hangings tied with cords and fine linen and purple to silver rings and marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and colored stones.
Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished in accordance with the bounty of the king. Drinking was by flagons without restraint, for the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as each one desired.
All right. So, what's the sense now? So we had 180 days of partying, and then what happens?
More party.
More party for another 7 days, another week. All right. And what? Again, what's the scene like during this 7 days? I mean, we already spent all our budget on the first 180 days of the production, right? And now we got to come up with another 7 days that seem to be even more over the top.
Yeah. It seems like he's bringing out the best of the best of everything he has now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the flagons, and the gold goblets, and the mm-hmm. white curtains, and the couches of gold and silver. Marble, mother of pearl, and colored stones, and
things limitless. It's just this very garish fantasy, and everything is geared towards indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing about partying like this, I guess. And this is, I don't know where this lands in relationship to them, but and we're just hearing about, reading about the way they just ate and drank and just, I don't know.
It's like, you know, they have a god of
partying,
you know, Bacchus. Like, you know, and it is, though, in that regard, it is partying like heaven.
Yeah.
You know, this is like, you know, in the biblical text, we see these images that the feast that has no end. You know, on this mountain, I will prepare a banquet. All of these images by Seah, where everything just runs, you know, like alcohol, wine just flows like rivers. There is this excessive image. But in the biblical text, it often refers to whose work? Who's doing the party? Who's throwing the party normally? God. And in much of the Greek mythology, that's the attempt, is to make this look very different from human everyday life. Who's in the 7-day party now? We had all the top brass and the first party for 180 days. Who's been invited to the 7-day party?
All the people.
All the people.
All the people, great and small. So now you bring everybody from town. Everybody who's been listening to this party going on for 180 days and called the police 20 times, now gets invited over, you know, to come over to the palace to see this. What's the function of those 7 days then?
This is where the detail, this is where the descriptive part comes in. Where you have this picture that's really clear of all this, I mean, colors and you know, what these things look like. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. in the earlier party, you know, you heard about it, everybody was there,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the people who were there. But this is very vivid.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost heightens the importance of this.
Mm-hmm. Like the intensity of this now, you know, the kind of thing that you thought we had party hard, and now we're really going to pull out all the stops. And so there's this, and the beauty of the way that it's told. You know, again, there's a sense that the storyteller is working very hard. I mean, all they have is words. The storyteller would be doing this around a campfire, and he's really getting into it and adding a little bit more here and there. You know, we may have different details. This is really, when you think about movie making, this is where movie making, you know, give a, you know, complete blank check to the special effects for this one scene that doesn't last very long. I mean, we've barely made it through 4 paragraphs so far, you know, and we've already double spent.
It seems like an attempt to pacify the ordinary people after all the bigwigs were partying for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, all right, let's throw them a little bone so that they don't get mad and
So there is some sense, yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe share a little bit of it. And now, and there's where we might hear that differently as well. You know, one of the comments in the group in Posto was, this is intended in part to not just pacify him, but also make it very clear that Ahasuerus is not really like them. You know, this is how the other half, this is how they live. You know, not how the rest of the people live. You know, and for most of the folks in that community, and probably for most of us, I don't know that we would necessarily have ever been to a party like this. And that would be a question to think about. What is the most elaborate and excessive party we have ever been to? You know? For most of the folks in the group that I was working with, it was interesting because it ran the gamut. You know, most of the parties that they went to that were significant would have been communal parties. And many of them had very little, not even birthday parties because of economics. And so the idea of seeing this kind of an excessive party was pretty overwhelming. If they've ever been to one, it's usually a service within that party. You know, never as the guests to the party. But much of what seems to be here is to, you know, the sense of providing the king, the image of the king as absolute in power, military, he's got all his military there, he's got all of his novels, so there's wealth. There's this excess. And then there's another element here that is also usually associated with the divine, with gods given to the king. And that is the sense that he is being extremely generous. You know, all of the sense that it's lavish, flagons of wine, without restraint. But the king had given orders that anyone could do whatever they wanted. This is like serious, serious.
If this was Shakespeare setting the king up for a harsh fall, it just kind of, I don't know, one of the stock stories of when somebody is just really has bad advising and is really heading on the wrong path. They always start out really high.
So he's getting set up. Well, let's see what happens then.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
When you talk about that, thinking about why that's the most lavish party we've been to, it's interesting because my mind immediately switched to this wedding I went to in El Salvador from a connections. A friend of mine whose family had come from one of the richest, wealthiest families in El Salvador. And really, to tell you the truth, it probably wasn't any fancier than a wedding up here.
Mm-hmm.
But because I was living in a different, because down there I was living out in the countryside with people who are much poorer than people that I live alongside here in this country, it seemed so much more extravagant.
Yeah.
But if you would put it next to weddings that I've been to here, it really wasn't. And
yeah.
yet, to me, it felt so much more extravagant.
Yeah. Well, and I really appreciate you mentioning, because that is very true, again, in terms of how, so it, you know, in this group, and also what part of what they started to talk about was some of their first experiences of parties in the U.S., you know, where, especially early on, before they kind of made that transition to the level of wealth, their first experience of the United States in general was this kind of excess. You know, this sounds over-the-top excessive in the same way, you know, what's the average wedding cost in the United States right now? I don't know, probably somewhere around $12,000. I mean, that's several years of income for some people around the world, you know? So it is just mind-bogglingly, whatever, excessive. Yeah, that's probably more accurate.
Single day, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm. And this is intended to be 180 days of that. And then 7 days of that. So we have this set up. This is Mr. Sanchez. He's been set up. So let's see what happens to King Ahasuerus and all his party.
Furthermore, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women of the palace of King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the king was merry with wine, he commanded Bitha, Arvona, Bitha, and Abagatha, and Kaikas, the seven eunuchs who attended him, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing the royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the officials her beauty, for she was fair to behold.
But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command conveyed by the eunuchs. At this, the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him.
We'll stop there, you know, because it kind of goes into lots of detail there, but let's stop there for a second. What did you notice these two short
names?
Name
the eunuchs. Mm-hmm. They actually gave them names.
Well,
and the women hadn't been at the party.
No. This is a separate party. Again, another thing, they had 180 days of men partying with all the alcohol available. And set on top. And in the meantime, and it's interesting, just even the first phrase, furthermore. It's like, okay, there's this ball party going on the side. And furthermore, we get a one-night party for Vashti, but you know, that is what she's doing. But they're separate.
Given this new information, I feel like I read the the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as each one desired. I feel like there's maybe this ambiguity that then makes me wonder, you know, I think in times you have men and women who said they're doing, you know, what our carnal desires may be, and alcohol playing into the situation.
I don't know.
Yeah. And that's more questions.
Yeah. Well, what's everybody's sense? I mean, you know, it's what's happening in this party? The women are separate partying in a separate location, but are there women at this party? And who, which women would be at this party? And what is their role? Servants, prostitutes, abuse. I mean, like this is, and this was a really painful part of reading this passage, you know, this part of the story with this group of women, because for many of them, the sense of vulnerability. And I think this is probably more common for many other people, like the sense of vulnerability that this party creates. You know, the excess and the contrast of wealth and power and who, you know, and on whose back is this partying happening?
It is scary when all the men in the country or in the area have been drunk for, you know, 7 days. and all the people in power have been drunk for 6 months.
So I think the part, the 7 days party is to placate the common masses so that they would aspire, oh yes, we have tasted this, now we're going to go. Rather than the hatred the division causes, you sample the wine and then you are forever in because you aspire to.
And it's that double-edged sword in the way that they're trying to control the population. You know, if you think about it in terms of controlling the population, if there's anger within the population, both that we're giving you a piece of it to appease you, and on the other hand, we're also impressing you to the point that you know better than to mess with us.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole thing, and Carol mentioned it, the sense of this reveals a deep-seated insecurity about King Ahasuerus. We're starting to get that sense of Ashantanari that he's quite insecure. And in his insecurity, he's throwing all these parties to sort of make up for it. And then comes what he does with Vashti. So what does he want with his...
Well, I think that just shows the role, the husband-wife role, like what they mean to each other,
mm-hmm.
or what she means to him, because she's just property.
Yeah.
She's a trophy wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
where's the runway?
Why is it significant that the seven men are mentioned, the seven eunuchs? Well, first of all, does anybody know what a eunuch is? I should just clarify that.
Castrated.
You know, so a castrated male, and they were the ones who were in charge of the women because they were castrated. And so they were castrated both because they would have no no progeny, so there was no risk that they would steal the money from the king in order to pass it on to their children or whatever. And then also that, you know, the assumption was that they would also not be tempted to, you know, mess around at the king's harem. So, and there's seven of these eunuchs. One of the elements, again, of this group of women also read and hear in this mentioning of the seven names is that these seven men are sent to go get Vashti. What a scary sense that is. Is there an assumption that Vashti isn't going to come? Does the king already know that this is going to happen? Is it his idea to send for her? Or is this whole sense of, you know, kind of a bunch of men in a frat party trying to kind of, you know, bring a woman out here, you know, and to try to bring her out, and then that they know she's not going to come willingly into this party. And so the seven men being sent to get her, rather than, you know, I've usually have read that almost as a sense that she's going to be brought up in a pedestal or something. But their sense is, here's a group of men going to force her to come before the king. So there's already the tension beginning to build. Anything else that you notice in the text? What do you make of Queen Vashti's refusal?
I wish we had more information.
Mm-hmm. So why would you?
Well, because we don't really know if she was angry or fearful or just didn't feel like it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she may have just miscalculated her role, her power over her guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, she was the most beautiful. She was the queen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she may have thought that she could show that she was mad about this.
Never let me party.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because in a story that has a lot of details, it's also significant to figure out the details that are missing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't have a lot of detail about her decision.
Mm-hmm.
We just know that she flat out refuses to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in some ways this is a story where, it, you know, what much of the rabbinical material does with the stories in general, but particularly with the story, is to fill in the lots of gaps, because there's many of them. And the sense is that that's part of what we can do with the story, to try to figure out what it is that, you know, what are some motivations? If you think about the context, you know, one of the women in the group that did this with, she said, he hasn't thought of her for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden he wants her to show up, you know? You know, one of them had asked the question because it says, you know, Queen Vashti before the king wearing the royal crown. Well, there's one of the commentators I read of this says, Hebrew is kind of confusing. It doesn't clarify, but that's all she's going to be wearing when she comes before the king. I mean, it doesn't, the language is very intentionally, you know, sort of confusing. in the way that it felt. So but there's a sense that she's refusing that utilitarian approach to her, that property approach to her, or is it, you know, less complicated than that?
It's funny, this is, you know, one of those stories that's got a female protagonist, but even growing up hearing it, people saying, you know, be like Esther, blah, 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 blah. Queen Vashti is still viewed as being, is almost just looked down upon. There was no, I wonder what she was thinking. It was always, she was too self-involved in throwing a party for her friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so not all women are great, but we got one.
Oh,
you know? So it's kind of one of those stories, I'm thinking about it, there's a lot of stories that say women can have power when they speak truth to men. And this is kind of
mm-hmm.
one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But not all women, I don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of like exception proves the rule thing, which is disturbing about some of these female protagonist stories.
Yeah. And so that oftentimes, that is often the case in how this story gets interpreted, is that the two queens are looked at very differently and contrasted, but there may be a lot more similarities between them, you know, in terms of how they approach. Another element of the conversation with the group of postal that was really, again, difficult and painful is for many of the women in this group, they happen to have had experiences of a lot of abuse within their relationships, you know, whether it was in their home lives, in their you know, as children, and then also as spouses, and so and alcohol was often involved, and so the terror for them, I don't think that there was necessarily even a lot of lack of clarity about the reasons for Vashti not to come. You know, their immediate assumption is that it's a sense of terror about entering into this world of men that have been influenced by alcohol, that are set on showing power, and her own sense of vulnerability in entering into it, as well as the consequence of, you know, of not playing her part, of not doing what she's expected to do as a woman, that she does pay a high price. And in the interpretation that you're saying has often been given to the story, she's blamed for those consequences, you know, for the fact that she loses so much in just standing up for herself. So the king is enraged, and anger burns within him. Let's continue.
Then the king consulted the sages who knew the laws, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law and custom. And those next to him were Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Ratsana, and Memugan, the seven officials of Persia and Media who had access to the king and sat first in the kingdom.
According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus, conveyed by the eunuchs?
Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials,
not only has Queen Vashti done wrong to the king, but also to all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will rebel against the king's officials, and there will be no end to the contempt, end of contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it may not be altered, that Vashti is never again to come before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout the kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike.
One more paragraph.
This advice pleased the king and the officials, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, declaring that every man should be master in his own house.
Yeah. Let's go back then through and reaction, thoughts. Word of the Lord.
That showed her.
That showed her.
And they tried to pass a law that said women have to do whatever their men say or something like that.
You know, it's portrayed that way. It's portrayed as this extreme, bizarre culture. Even the way that the language of the law, of the means of the person, like, they're going to have to be changed, you know. It is portrayed as something foreign and strange as well. I mean, the audience for this is not the person of means. You know, the audience for this is a group, you know, within a Jewish community, often read by cackling and laughing. And so, you know, there's intentional kind of parody here of the Persian law. What else do you, what strikes you? Yeah, it's funny, painful, weird.
Kind of ridiculous. I mean, the kingdom being, what is the word for it? I mean, if it was a sitcom, you know, he'd be the husband that everybody has no idea what's going on.
Everybody loves
him. And everybody all around him, sort of doing this other stuff.
Yeah, we begin to get a sense, or we already have a sense of a king that you had said initially is still insecure. He had access to lots of power. He's a very new king, only 3 years under his belt. He's done what seems to be a fairly responsible thing by bringing everybody together and partying on and on. And now, when he's got this crisis, I mean, think about what Vashti has done. Everything, 180 days of partying, 7 days additional, are all set to do one thing, impress. And he cannot get his woman there. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, think about the fall. You said he had been set up for a fall. This is about as bad as it gets for him, because he's trying to impress everybody. And he cannot control his woman.
But they gave her so much. I mean, they're like, oh my God, this is just going to be the downfall of the kingdom, you know? And everyone is, this one little act of saying no is going to just...
Now, it's a parody, but is it real? Is it realistic in the way that people in power feel when they are threatened?
Well, look at the politicians who are out with women and then their wife stands with them in front of the media and say, you know, and you go, I'm surprised that they do that, but they often do.
There's this expectation that women will stand by their man, and in doing so, if I can have soul, you know, then everybody else.
It's the whole, I mean, Hillary and Bill thing. If she left him, she would have been the woman who left the man, you know, and if she stayed with him, she's the woman who put up with it. And there's no right answer.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the king himself, like, you know, said as well, there is no, he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah,
and so he consults.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he, again, like, he's talking in the third person, you know, what is the command to
be,
you know, he doesn't, he's just sort of looking for other people's advice. He can't make his own decision. Again, that sort of goes with the insecurity that Carol's not talking about.
And these are elements that are going to be really significant throughout the entire book about who gets to influence the law. You know, and the role of the law is hugely significant. This will become the law of the land. I mean, by his advisory group, they get to decide what the law is. So this begins to challenge within the, you know, within the stakes. It really is challenging the definition of law as equal to justice. You know, that there isn't necessarily an equality between the two. In reading this with a group of folks in Post Hill, a couple of things that were significant for them is the way that, you know, when you think about the way that immigrants are defined, particularly in Mexico and the country are documented. We had a conversation earlier about the term illegal. Part of the intent of that is the assumption, the biggest resistance to immigration for many people, the biggest excuse against immigration as well, if they just follow the law. And the assumption is that the law is benign. In this case, what we see throughout the book of Esther is that the law is done to please those in power. Notice the phrase that it says, this advice pleased the king. We'll hear that phrase throughout the book. Of course it pleases the king and all the other men. I mean, what's not to like, right? In the decision that they've made. So the laws must be adjusted for those who can't be trusted. And this is the theme throughout the book, which VeggieTales picks up on this song in the Esther movie on VeggieTales, which I highly recommend. And that's the refrain of Haman coming to the king and saying repeatedly, the laws must be adjusted for those who can't be trusted. First is Vashti, then it will be the Jews. And so the parody of the book is largely, or one of the ends of it, is to kind of figure out how do people without power live within a community with such great wealth and power. What are their options? What is Vashti's option? You know, damage she does, damage she does. What are Esther's and her people's choices to live within this place where they do not control the law? Well, thanks for beginning conversation to this. We'll move a little quicker through the rest. This was a lot of introductory material.